Hi, I'm Tej Singh, and welcome to Office Hours with Dorm Room Fund, where we interview some of the most successful people in startups, technology, and corporate America. Dorm Room Fund is a student-run venture capital firm backed by First Run Capital. We write seed checks of $20,000 into startups founded by fellow students. Since our founding in 2014, we've funded over 275 startups, which are now collectively worth over $1 billion and have gone on to raise over $500 million in follow-on funding from Sequoia, Andreessen Horowitz, Accel, and others. To pitch us, go to dormroomfund.com. Enjoy this episode. Hi, I'm Tej Singh, and I'm joined by Adele Lee. Today we're interviewing Melissa Mash, the co-founder and CEO of Dagny Dover. So, to begin with, what'd you think you'd be when you grew older?
I had many dreams. So as a kid, I really like homes. I really like real estate. So I thought maybe I'd be a real estate agent or an architect. Or, you know, then my major in undergrad at NYU was Metropolitan Studies, which is the study of cities. And some people go on to either become lawyers or architects or city planners or social workers. And so social work was always something I was really interested in, but I also didn't want to necessarily, you know, be subjected to really sad and tough things and emotions every day. I definitely wanted to have like a stable family life and so on. So I was also really interested in fashion and the business side of fashion. And so that's where I pursued my internships.
From your interest of fashion, how did you get into the bag space?
So I had a lot of internships in college. Going to NYU is, you know, an amazing opportunity to be able to test drive certain industries and certain companies. And after a number of experiences, I was like, I really want to work for a company that is a really well-oiled machine, something that's really well-funded, something that, you know, they have programs in place where I can learn. And so I started an internship at Coach, and that's where I started my career eventually. And then that's where I, you know, saw the opportunity for what became Dagny Dover after.
So now let's switch to Dagny Dover and the founding story of Dagny Dover. You started the company while you were in your MBA. What was that experience like for you? And what was the feeling of being a student founder like, especially as you were going through an MBA program?
Yeah. So I went back to get my MBA with the idea already. And so I went back to, and I had never considered going back to business school or grad school prior to that. It was just like, I'm just going to hustle and I'm going to work and I'm just going to work my way up. And why do I have to go back to school? As I said, I was like not that into school, but it became apparent that like the way this was going to be the most successful is if I went to business school, and a particular business school, one that really had the resources and the right, you know, clout behind it and the right momentum behind it in order to elevate what I was trying to do. So I chose to go to Wharton and was really excited about that. But that means I spent my time there being very productive in terms of chairing the Wharton Entrepreneurship Conference so that I could network with all the investors there and network with all the other founders who we invited to speak on the panels. And the only clubs that I really spent any time on were the Entrepreneurship Club and a little bit of the Retail Club. Any trek that I went on was a supply chain, global supply chain and retail trek to Asia, et cetera. So everything I did was very pointed. It was never, I don't want to say I didn't like do things for fun, but I wasn't there for like a break. I was there to get to work and to learn things that I didn't already know from my job experience, because I had the liberal arts degree from undergrad. You know, I really need to go there and learn like the basics of business.
I think it's really unique that you came into your MBA program with an idea already in mind. Can you talk a little bit about how you actually arrived at this particular idea and what the inflection point for you was to understand that this was kind of the brand you wanted to create within the retail space?
Yeah. So I, as I mentioned, I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. I've had lots of ideas in the past, and it's not about having a good idea, right? It's the right idea that works for you. It's the right idea that you think that you're the right person to execute. That's the right time, that like all these things have to work. It's really just not about the idea in itself. So when I was working for Coach in London, I was turning around its first store at Heathrow Terminal 5. It was their first store in Europe. It was a really important store strategically for the whole company, but it was failing miserably for a lot of reasons. At the time, I had moved to Europe and they said, hey, actually, we have a job for you. If you can go interview with our distribution partner, we think you'd be perfect for it. And so there I was. I walked in at the age of 24 and was able to manage a store, this 10-person team. They all spoke different languages, which made it very hard to communicate with them. And of course, for them to communicate with each other and to, you know, help each other sell and explain the brand and all of that. The store was at Heathrow Terminal 5, which is a very posh British Airways exclusive terminal. It has every longstanding European brand in the terminal, Dior, Prada, Gucci, etc. And people didn't know what Coach was. So this was really like introducing a brand for the first time in a new market and having to explain it from scratch and to show why people should spend their hard-earned money on your brand versus something that they've known for decades. So through that experience, spoke with customers every day and learned that people had a lot of bag problems. And while there was Tumi in the terminal, while there was Kors, while there was Longchamp, people didn't want that. They wanted something that was really fashionable, that was made of performance materials, because these were people who were running from business to travel to, you know, to home with the kids, etc. It needed to flex between the different aspects of their life. And they wanted to not have to spend, you know, $1,000 for a high quality bag. And I knew from my experience at Coach Corporate prior that you could produce a really high quality product and it didn't have to sell for $500 as long as you didn't have a ton of distribution channels and very expensive freestanding retail stores. If you were really choosy about where you spent your capital, then you could sell directly to customers, have direct relationships with them, especially through digital. And it being 2009 at the time, this was the age of Bubble Bar and Bonobos, and you know, digitally native brands were becoming like a real thing with real momentum. It was a real business model, and I knew that, you know, I could do this with a relatively small amount of capital.
Can you talk about some of the learnings from Corporate Coach in regards to, say, for example, related to margins or the distribution strategy of why sometimes certain stores are flagship and they're not necessarily there to drive the most revenue but to enhance the brand?
Yeah, you know, like certainly Coach had that mentality, and almost every single brand at the time had the mentality, if you needed to be on X road in Hong Kong or X, you know, road in New York in order to, and you needed to spend, you know, millions of dollars in real estate every year on that location, even if it lost money because it's a status symbol and you need to be present in front of the global stage, right? But the truth is that if it's not making money, how is that going to serve you long term? And especially if you're reporting to Wall Street, how is that going to end well for anyone? You know, so I learned a lot of lessons in terms of things that were the norm back then and in the way that things are now, where you see a lot of retailers pulling out of prime real estate because it doesn't make sense financially. Also, in the same way, you know, at that point in time, distribution was key. You know, the more stores that you were in, if you need to be in all the Macy's, you need to be in all the Bloomingdale's, etc., that was meant to be a sign of pride and that was meant to be a sign of, you know, success, when that is not at all how we measure success now. We are in about 2% of the retailers who reach out to us. We're very selective about which stores we enter because over distribution, we know will kill your brand overnight. And there's no reason to you know, for us to do that when our business is extremely healthy, etc. So there have been a lot of learnings, I think, in terms of where a lot of brands have learned. A lot of these traditional longstanding brands have learned that they've misstepped over the past decade.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting how the relationship between, there's like a pendulum shift as people enter stores, then exit stores. Obviously now a lot of the digitally native brands are entering stores as they saturate some of these online channels, and CAC starts to rise and becomes in parity with the retail stores. Can you talk about whether, you know, you have stores, do you have any plans, if, why not?
Yeah, so we've had a pop-up open. We just recently closed it because we're prepping to open a permanent location soon this year. But, you know, what's really important is that you open stores at the right time when you can afford it, where it's, I mean, again, not every brand will agree to this, but for us, where you're going to be profitable, where you have a very good sense of, if you're not going to be profitable, that you have a very good sense of exactly when you will be profitable, you know exactly what that store is going to do, not only in terms of volume, but in terms of brand building, in terms of a billboard effect, etc., and that you know the benefits of that outweigh any sort of cost involved.
And so are there any, for our entrepreneurs out there listening, how do you open a pop-up shop? I think there's brands like Four Post, and now even there's certain brands where you can buy shelf space. Mm-hmm. How have you thought about what locations to open, and how do you buy billboards, for example? I think AdQuick, right, is a platform that's getting really popular that a lot of early brands are using.
You know, every brand has a different method for how they approach brand awareness or how they approach getting their physical products in front of people. For us, it's not a matter of just like being anywhere and everywhere and like, oh, we want to sit next to all the digitally native brands. In fact, we want to sit next to the traditional brands. It's not, you know, we want to definitely step away from being considered a startup brand, which I think we already have stepped away from, into being, you know, much more of a lifestyle brand. And so, you know, for us, like, it's never been super compelling for us to sit next to a bunch of other small brands, even though we're approached still constantly to be in those types of spaces. In our experience and as consumers, that's just not the most compelling shopping experience when there are five different brands and your visual, you know, that you're looking at on a wall, and they don't necessarily reflect the same lifestyle. They don't necessarily, you know, reflect the same spending power, price point, the assortment, the color scheme. Like, you need to own your experience. You need to own the visual experience for the customer too. So it's just really important to have your own freestanding retail store so that you can convey that to the customer and show them what makes you different.
And more on the topic of, because obviously opening stores, whether it's a full-time store or pop-up, requires capital. How do you think about, some brands have the strategy of raising a ton of capital, and then of course they have to, you know, deliver the returns commensurate with that, versus raising less capital and being able to grow slowly, but still being, you know, good ROI for investors. Have you thought about that?
You know, I think that something that founders really need to understand is that there are a lot of different ways to approach any one thing. And for us, it's always served us very well to always focus on the long-term gain, not the short-term gain. And so when you're thinking of who you're taking capital from and the types of pressures that they have, yeah, you might be able to easily raise $5 million in your first round, but you know what that means is that you have to perform that much faster and your life is not going to be that much more fun. You know, you have a lot of pressure to spend that money and to make that money, and you just can't hack a brand. It really is something that you have to cultivate over a long period of time, or else the customer knows that, hey, there was just a lot of money that was funneled toward this. That's not real. It's not organic. It's not authentic. It's not something I actually believe in, but I'll try it out maybe once. I'm not gonna, you know, go back and be a longtime customer there. So I really believe that you should do things very authentically in order to be successful in your relationship with the customer.
So let's wrap up with some quick questions, one sentence or less.
Okay.
If you had one extra hour of free time a day, how would you use it?
I would probably take a bath. Nice long bath with candles and, you know, eucalyptus.
You can have an unlimited supply of one thing for the rest of your life. What would it be?
Oh, time, for sure.
That's certainly an interesting answer, but it's worthwhile, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
If you could live anywhere in the world, where would it be?
London, central to everything.
If you had your own talk show, who would be the first three guests?
Ellen DeGeneres.
Fellow talk show host.
Yeah. She never gets to talk, right? Let's just keep it at one.
That's certainly fascinating. Yeah, you have a more in-depth conversation with one person. What's the best gift anyone's ever given you?
Good parents.
That's the most unique answer I've ever heard.
It's the most important. If you start your life with a good family that's stable without chaos, like, you are already way ahead of the game.
What childish things do you still do as an adult?
I sleep with my baby blanket.
Would you rather have a rewind button or a pause button on life?
Pause.
Would you rather be filthy rich and live 400 years ago or be middle class today?
Well, as a woman, I would 100% be middle class today because there were no opportunities for me 400 years ago.
Certainly fascinating.
What's something about you that people would be surprised to know?
People like the fun fact that I am an Italian opera singer. They seem to think that that's interesting.
Wow. Do you still pursue that passion now?
Absolutely not. I don't talk about that. But I do sing a lot.
And to wrap up, if you could choose your age forever, what age would you choose and why?
I think early 30s, like 32, is really good because you know who you are and you're not like struggling to, you know, to prove who you are anymore, but you're still young enough where you can do everything.
What a great note to end on. Thank you so much for your time.
Sure. Thank you.